This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh from Critical Theory Channel. Today, I'm honored to be speaking with Robin Waterfield. Robin Waterfield is the author of a wonderful book published by Oxford University Press in 2023. The book is called Plato of Athens, A Life in Philosophy. Robin Waterfield is an independent scholar and translator living in southern Greece. Robin, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you, Morteza. Thanks for the opportunity.
Before we start, it's customary to ask our guests to briefly introduce themselves, to talk about their field of expertise, and more importantly, why they decided to write the book, and especially the book on Plato, about his life. Can you please briefly tell us a little bit about yourself and why you decided to write this book?
Sure. I live in southern Greece, as you said, and I'm a full-time writer. I make my living entirely from writing. I write... In my time, I've written all sorts of books. I mean, from children's fiction and a book on hypnosis and all sorts of things. But over the last 20 years or so, it's been more or less entirely books on the ancient world. And a lot of them are translations. I translate ancient Greek prose, the historians and the philosophers, into English. And I write the occasional history book. And now this biography. How did the book come about, you ask? I was asked to do it by... the editor of Oxford University Press in New York. And I thought about it for a while because, I mean, what's kind of strange on the surface is that this is the first ever book-length biography of Plato. And with Plato, we're dealing with a philosopher who's pretty much a household name. But there are fairly good reasons, which I go into in the introductory section of the book, as to why nobody's taken up the challenge of writing a biography before. And we'll perhaps come to that, or shall I carry on now?
No, that would be good if you could explain why, because I wanted to ask what kind of biographical sources you use and why nobody wrote about it. So it would be good to know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there are two chief biographical sources. One, which is largely irrelevant, are Plato's dialogues himself. He mentions himself on three separate occasions in the dialogues, but they're all uninformative about himself and his life. And the kind of dialogues that he wrote, he doesn't put himself in them. He's more like a playwright. He has characters talk in his dialogues. So that's useless. The two more, more satisfying, but in some senses they're not. Another source of information are that there were quite a lot of ancient biographies. Biographies written in antiquity about Plato, because of course he was such a famous man. But they are really not very helpful. They get the kind of general trajectory of his life right, but most of the stories are gossipy, They stem from hostile biographical tradition as well as an overly eulogistic biographical tradition. They tell a lot of very silly stories. They're kind of the equivalent of celebrity gossip columns now. So they're really not very useful. I mean, as an example of a silly story, Plato died of shame when he was unable to answer a riddle, right? You get this kind of stuff, which isn't very helpful, but you know, you can tell one or two of the stories, and as I say, the general trajectory of his life they've got right. So that's one source, not a very helpful one. The best source are some letters. Now, we have a large number of letters from antiquity written under the name of Plato, but there are 13 of them which deserve to be taken quite seriously, because already by the end of the 3rd century, in other words, about 150 years after Plato's death, they were already included in the corpus of his other works. So they deserve to be taken seriously. And they are a good source of biographical information. And this is exactly why other scholars haven't written a biography of Plato, because a lot of scholars don't believe these letters to be authentic. And so they're stymied. They've got nowhere to go for biographical information. I believe, of the 13 letters, I believe that 3 are authentic. The reason I think they're authentic is mainly stylistic. The longest of them, letter 7, is longer than a lot of Plato's short dialogues. And the philosophy and the writing is challenging, but in keeping with what we know about Plato's style at the time that this letter was written, in the 350s. So I believe that letter 7, letter 8, and letter 3 are authentic. And so I base quite a lot of the biographical information on that, especially his trips to Syracuse, which we'll come to later. And that's it, really. The ancient biographies, one source, not very good, and the letters.
And there's a controversy about his name that you talk about in the book. But before that, I should ask you about maybe the political situation of Athens at the time that he was born. What was the political situation like? And it would be good also if you talk about the influence of pre-Socratic philosophers on him as well.
Okay. Plato was born, I believe Plato was born in 424 or 423. I'm following the work of a scholar called Deborah Nails on that. Whereas what you most commonly read is that he was born in 428 or 427. Either way, he was born within the first 10 years of what we call the Peloponnesian War. This was a war between Plato's native city, Athens, and Sparta, both of them immensely powerful, the Athenians particularly strong at sea, and the Spartans particularly strong at land. And they went to war because they were the two greatest states and they wanted to see who would come out on top. In the end, it was the Peloponnesians, the Spartans, who came out. So if Plato was born in 424 or 423, then he would have been still very young when a peace was made in 421. But it was only a temporary peace, and there was fighting still going on here and there in Greece and around the Mediterranean. But it was usually fighting between proxies so that the Spartans and the Athenians could pretend that that the peace was holding, which it wasn't. And it eventually broke down entirely. War resumed in 413. So by then, Plato would have been 11 or 12, by my reckoning. So Plato was, therefore, you know, a teenager at a time of war. More than that, in 415, the Athenians decided to try to take over the island of Sicily. This was an insane decision. Sicily is a large and troubled island, and it would have been impossible for the Athenians to control it from that distance. Some people in Athens even had greater ambitions. They wanted to conquer Sicily and then go on to conquer Carthage. In other words, they wanted a sort of a pan-Mediterranean empire. At the moment, their empire was centered really on the Aegean Sea to the east of Greece. They wanted a pan-Mediterranean empire. This was insane. And the Athenians came off really badly They were defeated ultimately after 2 years of warfare in Sicily. They were defeated. They lost 40,000 men, hundreds of ships, and so on and so forth. So more than the fact that Plato was growing up, was a teenager at a time of war, he was a teenager when it was pretty clear to anybody with sense that Athens was going to lose. So he was growing up in this really rather grim situation. And as I say, Athens did eventually lose. When, after the war, the Peloponnesians, the Spartans, imposed an oligarchy, they sabotaged the democracy, the famous Athenian democracy, and created an oligarchy, which was a cruel oligarchy. I think they were the first people in Europe to make people in Athens afraid, of the dawn knock on your door, what was going to happen next. But some of Plato's relatives were close relatives, were members of the oligarchy. And Plato tells us in Letter 7 that he was tempted, he was attracted by their idea of the sort of moral rearmament of post-democratic Athens, and was tempted to join them, but their cruelty put him off. So, it would have been normal for a young, ambitious, intelligent person from a wealthy family, as Plato was, to become a politician, to play a role in the public life of Athens. So it's natural that he would have wanted to do so. And on my dating of his birth, he was coming of age at precisely the time when the 30 tyrants were in power. So he was tempted, but they put him off. He was still tempted. He still wanted, I think, to be a politician. Perhaps he'd try now under the revived democracy once the 30 tyrants were expelled. The democracy was restored and Plato was tempted again. But then in 399, the democracy executed his beloved teacher Socrates. So after that, he gave up on practical politics for a long time and turned merely to theory. His name is definitely Plato. It's not an unknown name in Athens or elsewhere in the Greek world. In fact, there's another famous one, a writer of comedies, a playwright called, to distinguish him from philosophy, we just call him Plato Comicus. So it was a perfectly normal name, but the ancient biographical tradition that I spoke about earlier thought that he was called Aristocles and was kind of nicknamed Plato because the word Plato is related to a Greek word that could mean either stocky in build or perhaps broad in, with a broad mental horizons like that. Aristocles was his grandfather's name and on his father's side, and unusually in ancient Greece, the eldest son got the name of the grandfather. Not always, but quite often. So again, the ancient biographical tradition was assuming that Plato was the eldest son, which he wasn't. He had two older brothers and one older sister. So this was just a kind of a mistake that the ancient biographers made. What was the influence of the pre-Socratics? Well, he'd undoubtedly read them, but what he took from them was chiefly two strands, from the Parmenidean, from Parmenides and the Eleatic tradition. He took the idea of a kind of a metaphysical stability, that there are things that truly exist. And from the Heracliteans, he took the idea that the physical world, the material world as we see it, is in flux. And this was very important for developing his metaphysics, the famous theory of forms, which everybody has heard of, because he has Socrates in the early dialogue say, look, we can't say for sure that anything, any event, any person, any situation in the material world is, let's say, beautiful, because it would become ugly at some point, or from a different perspective it's not beautiful, or at a different time, or from a different viewer it's not beautiful. So we don't find the kind of stability that we want in the material world, but nevertheless we do use these identification terms like beautiful and courageous and just and all these moral terms. So if the Heraclitean instability of the world doesn't allow us to identify it, then the Eleatic stability of the metaphysical world allows us to identify it. So he posited this, the existence of these forms, immaterial, eternal, being exactly what they were, in other words, paradigms of just, beautiful, and so on and so forth. So that's the main influence of the pre-Socratics on him.
And you talked about his teacher Socrates. What did you learn from him in terms of political theory? And speaking of political theory, I'm also keen to know, and that I didn't know until I read your book, that at some point he wanted to become a politician, but he gave up the idea. So it would be good if we could talk about that as well.
I don't think I've got more to say on well, I mean, I can add more on that. Yeah, okay. Okay, Socratic politics. Everybody knows Plato's Republic. They know that this is a highly theoretical ideal city that he creates. He didn't expect it to, I think, exist in the exact form that it's written down. This was an ideal. This was something to aim for. And one of the things that, as I say, everybody will know about the Republic is that the rulers of the state are trained philosophers. Mm-hmm. They're put through a very arduous course of mathematics and philosophy. And at the end of the course, they're then told, you've got to go back now and be rulers. Because you're philosophers, because you know what the good is, that's the goal of the philosophical training in Republic, because you know what the good is, you and you alone are equipped to go back in back into the cave, if you like, according to that famous metaphor in the Republic, go back to the city, rule it. Now, this, in my view, was exactly what Socrates was up to. He had a group of people around him, mostly young men, not entirely young men, but almost entirely young. And I think that he was training those, in some sense of the word training. We have really no idea what was going on in the Socratic circle. But I think in some sense he was training these young men to be the next generation of philosophically enlightened rulers of Athens. And I think that's what Plato took from it at any rate. You wanted me to talk about... Okay, I've said that he did want to be a politician, that this was perfectly normal for a young man of his class, but he was put off first by the cruelty of the 30 tyrants and then by the execution of Socrates by the restored democracy. So at that point, he gave up practical politics. But we'll find, I imagine this, we're going to have a question on this later, but I'll jump ahead. Yes. 20 years or so later, in the 380s, he made a first visit to Syracuse, mainly as a sightseer, and mainly I think he was more interested in southern Italy, in meeting Pythagoreans who had their schools in southern Italy and also in Sicily, and that was the main reason. He would undoubtedly have met the current tyrant of Syracuse. Syracuse was the most powerful city in Sicily, who was a man called Dionysius I. But there's no record that they did meet. So I'm sure they did, because, you know, monarchs like to have famous people in their court. And, you know, here was a really famous philosopher visiting Syracuse. So I'm sure Dionysius I invited him to court and met him, but it didn't come to anything. 20 years or so later, by which time Dionysius' son, Dionysius II, was on the Syracusan throne, Plato went back more than once, particularly at the request of a friend he'd made on his first visit, a young man then called Dione, who was immensely wealthy, very, very close to the monarchic court. And Dione said, look, Dionysius II is not cut from the same cloth as his father. He has the possibility to become a philosopher. So Plato took up practical politics again. He decided to go to Syracuse. He went more than once and try to not try to put Dionysius II through the whole curriculum of the Republic, because that was like a 15-year course or 20-year course, I think, before the philosophers of the Republic were allowed to be rulers. But he wanted to convince him that absolute monarchy was not the way to go. And he and Dion and Dionysius II tried to, persuade Dionysius II that what we would call a constitutional monarchy would be better, mm-hmm. where, you know, the people have some say and it's not all about just what the monarch says and does. Excuse me. So he did return to practical politics, but that too came to nothing. It turned out that Dionysius II wasn't suitable material. Mm-hmm. Too arrogant, I think, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about his philosophy. You go on to describe the distinction he made between knowledge and belief, and I'm also keen to know if you really believe that philosophy is the only viable educational system. Can you talk about this, please?
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the theory of forms.
Yeah.
So we've got, as it were, two worlds there, or two layers of reality: the absolute reality of the forms and the semi-reality of the material world. So in order to know something, Plato believed that the object of knowledge has to be stable and true, obviously. And so he found that in the forms. So what we can know are forms, or at any rate, what we can know is something that stays the same, whereas we can only have belief of all other things. So that's the basic distinction. I believe it to be a very important distinction nowadays, because we are bombarded by beliefs, by opinions, especially through social media and things like that. And we all know from, you know, reading the newspapers and so on and so forth, how dangerous this can be, how elections can be influenced from China or somewhere, something like this. Because people are taking on these opinions and not checking them. Plato said that you can, through dialogue, change somebody's beliefs so that they now have true beliefs rather than shaky or false or unsound beliefs. And then he said that once you've got a true belief, if you find out why it's true, then you're converting that belief into knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that to be very important, as I say, in the context of social media, that people shouldn't just take on board the sometimes crazy, you know, QAnon type opinions that they're getting from the web, but they should think about it, find out why that belief might be true, and then they would find that, you know, the QAnon people hopefully would find that what they believe isn't true. But unfortunately, of course, none of them undertake this exercise of converting belief into knowledge. Mm-hmm. Did Plato believe that philosophy was the only viable educational system? Yes, certainly. You've got to remember that philosophy, well, until really the beginning of the 19th century, the term philosophy was much broader than we think of it nowadays.
Yeah.
Philosophy up until, as I say, you know, the 19th century included psychology, for instance, or meteorology or geography, or, you know, if you studied any of these things, you were called a philosopher. If you did mathematics, you were called a philosopher. So philosophy for Plato was that broad. And later, when we talk about the teaching that went on in the academy, we'll see that in more detail. The philosophy was broad, but I think he believed that his method of teaching, I suppose, would make it the only viable educational system. There were other schools. There were other schools of philosophy, or again, because philosophy was a broad term, there was the school of Isocrates, who called what he was teaching philosophy, whereas to us it was more a teaching in rhetoric, and, you know, how to be successful in the world, how to be a successful politician, was Socrates' chief. To Plato, that was not the whole of philosophy. So, yeah, he thought that his educational system was the educational system. What was the best one in? Perhaps not only viable. That might be getting too far, but certainly the best
one. Can you did talk a little bit about Plato's travels, but did he travel much around to see other thinkers such as Dion or Pythagoreans?
Dion wasn't really a philosopher. He was a member of Plato's academy. When he was sent into exile from Syracuse, he did join the academy. But he was chiefly, you know, simply a very high-ranking Syracusan. But yeah, as I said, First time he went to Sicily, when Dionysius the First was still on the throne, he had spent some weeks beforehand in southern Italy visiting Pythagoreans there. The southern Italy had been the sort of center of Pythagoreanism for, oh, well, quite a long time. I mean, 150 years or so more. And there were other Pythagoreans at Syracuse that you might meet as well in Sicily. But the ancient biographical tradition attributes a great many other travels to him, as they do to pretty much everybody, you know, because Egypt was considered an ancient and wise society. Then people like Plato attributed with visits to Egypt and also further east to Babylon and all around the Mediterranean. These should be taken not just with a pinch of salt. I think they're completely false. So really, really the only traveling he did was to Sicily. And I should say that, you know, the information about his visits to Syracuse we get chiefly from the letters. And that is the main biographical information we have about him. So it makes an account of his life, such as I've written, seem slightly uneven. Because, you know, there are periods where nothing was happening, and then suddenly we know a lot about his visits to Syracuse. I actually don't think that's false. I think the periods between visits to Syracuse were simply quiet times. He was writing, he was thinking, he was teaching. I compare him to the author of Lord of the Rings, J.R.R. Tolkien, who was an Oxford don, and apart from writing his books, the rest of his life was signally dull. It was the life of a conventional middle class Oxford don, and that's all. And I think Plato's situation was pretty much the same. These visits were the highlights of a career which was otherwise quiet.
Let's talk about his academy. So how did he go about establishing the academy? What sort of intellectual trends did he teach there, and what was his role there in the academy?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. It's quite an unusual answer, and we'll come up with. All right, in 383, Plato founded the academy. Now, it's called the academy because it was traditional for philosophers. Well, philosophers were public figures. Socrates, for instance, probably taught in the Agora, in the main marketplace, central square of Athens. But we also hear about him visiting gymnasia. Gymnasia were very prominent buildings in ancient Greek cities, and the one that Plato decided to make use of was just outside the city limits, northwest of the city of Athens, and it was sacred to a local hero called Hecademus or Academus. So he was going to the gymnasium of Academus, and that's why all our institutions are now called academies. No more than that. So in 383, he decided he had to do this, and he started teaching in the gymnasium, just as later Aristotle would teach in the Lyceum gymnasium, and Antisthenes taught in the Kynosarges gymnasium, and etc., etc. Now, the academy was slow to take off. Well, Plato first would have been dealing largely with an intake of young men, late teenagers, early 20s, for whom attending some lectures on philosophy was simply a way of rounding out their education. They weren't intending to become philosophers, but philosophy was considered a higher education. And they wouldn't only have been going and listening to Plato teaching either. They'd have been attending other philosophers who were teaching in Athens. And so that was always going to be the, as it were, meat of what went on in the academy, this annual or biannual intake of young men occasionally coming, walking out from the center of Athens and attending a lecture in the gymnasium of Academus. A little later, Plato also bought a property nearby. I lived there, and it was quite a large house and garden, and other teaching went on there. And I think that the chief distinction is, as I say, the young men of Athens were taught in the gymnasium, but the core group of high-level researchers who came to populate the academy would have, I think, met in Plato's house. Not least once a week, they'd have had a symposium, a learned symposium, where they discussed things and things like that. So that's where, you know, when by the 360s, the academy was attracting substantial thinkers. It attracted young Aristotle. Aristotle was a member of a researcher in the academy and doing some teaching as well for 20 years. Other famous people are Plato's nephew, Speusippus, who became the second head of the school after Plato's death. Eudoxus of Cnidus, who revolutionized Greek astronomy, and so on. There were lots of famous people in the academy. As I say, this inner circle of core researchers. Now, Plato's role is very curious. We've got a lot of Aristotle's works, far from complete, but we've got a lot of them. And he's very critical of Plato. It's not just that he disagrees with Plato's theories, his metaphysics, pretty much everything he disagrees with Plato about. And sometimes he suggests that Plato is less than clear about some of the things he's saying. Right, Aristotle was in the academy for 20 years. If Plato was less than clear about something, Aristotle could have gone to him and said, can you clarify this, please, Plato? But that does not seem to have happened. So I think Plato took on some of the teaching of the young men in the gymnasium. But as far as the researchers were concerned, I think he may have acted as a trigger in the sense of suggesting lines of research. But after that, he pretty much left them to get on with what they were doing on their own. And so as a result, it's not just Aristotle, but Speusippus, Xenocrates, Eudoxus, who had a theory about pleasure, they all came, when they were developing their own views, they all came to disagree with Plato on this point or the other. So this is really important. The academy was not and never was, well, no, never was in Plato's time or for a while afterwards. It never was a school for the perpetuation of Platonism. It was a school for original research. It was a school to foster, promising young minds. But it wasn't a school for the perpetuation of Platonism. What sorts of stuff was taught there? There was a lot of emphasis on mathematics. There was even a story, undoubtedly false, that arose later, that Plato had inscribed over the entrance to the academy, "Let no one who is ignorant of geometry enter here." So, as I say, the story is false, but it does show that there was, it's correct in that there was a very high, very strong influence of, very strong emphasis on studying the mathematical sciences, arithmetic, geometry, astronomy, harmonics. But beyond that, pretty much everything you can think of was studied or researched by the researchers in the academy. We know, for instance, that they were starting to do a kind of a taxonomy of plants. They studied politics, at least in the sense that they studied other cities' constitutions and political systems and what was good about them and what was bad about them. Now, this became very important because another very surprising thing about the academy is that it wasn't just pure philosophy. It wasn't just theoretical politics. The academy was approached, not so much in the 360s, I think, but later in the 350s and 340s, and then after Plato's death. Plato died in 347. The academy was approached by city-states from around the Eastern Mediterranean to, let's say they approached Plato, we don't know that they approached Plato, but the letter would have gone, "Dear Plato, our constitution's in a mess. Can you send somebody to sort it out, please?" And that's what they did. So, and again, there was no party line here. It wasn't some of the political troubleshooters who went out from the academy to other city-states developed more democratic constitutions for that state. Others didn't. Some went to overthrow a tyrant, a monarch. Others went to become monarchs themselves. Whatever they felt, whatever an individual academician felt was the suitable solution for the particular state that he was sent to was what they did. But this is really quite extraordinary. It was like a kind of a RAND corporation. I don't know whether the RAND corporation still exists, but you know, they're sort of a think tank for politics, but also doing some practical work as well.
And What, apart from metaphysics and epistemology, what was Plato's contribution to ethics?
Well, like all, I think it's safe to say all philosophers, thinkers at the time who were thinking about ethics, his conception of ethics was what we call eudaimonistic. That is to say that human well-being, we call it eudaimonistic. It comes from the Greek word eudaimonia, which is traditionally translated happiness. It's not a happy translation because happiness to us sounds like pleasure, something. But eudaimonia really means human flourishing, fulfilling your potential as a human being. So all, as I say, Plato and all the other thinkers believed that eudaimonia was the goal in life. They just differed about how to reach that goal. I mean, for a hedonist, pleasure was what made you happy, what allowed you to flourish as a human being. But Plato, no, obviously it's not going to be pleasure, but it's going to be an intellectual goal, and particular the development of... So, yeah, we should understand first intellectually why eudaimonia is the goal, and then we should develop the virtues which allow us to flourish. So Plato believed not pleasure, but the being a virtuous person, having those dispositions and skills to cope as a good person, as a morally good person with life. That's his main contribution to ethics. But the early dialogues are also what we call the early dialogues, the sort of shorter ones that feature Socrates very prominently, are also largely ethical in nature, but in a kind of a negative way. It's almost as if, you know, the dialogues show Socrates in conversation with somebody, and what he's doing is undermining that person's moral beliefs, because you live by your moral beliefs. And if your life has gone wrong, if it's not the sort of life that's going to bring you eudaimonia, bring you happiness, then you need kind of reorienting. And the way Plato went about reorienting people was to argue that their moral conceptions were unsound, and so they needed to rethink it along, better lines. So that's a very important aspect of his ethical writing, was these short early dialogues.
And did he ever try to put his political ideas into practice? You talk about him visiting
Dionysius.
I always mix up the names. Yeah, Diet of Syracuse.
Well, as I said before, I don't think I've got more to add on this. I mean, yes, I think he did. I think he wanted to, as I say, not to go as far as what we find in the Republic, which, as I say, is more idealism than practicable. But there's another, his longest book is another work of political philosophy. It's probably the last one he wrote, or at least he was working on it for the last decade of his life. And it's called The Laws, because that's what it is. It's largely a series of laws for another imagined community, which bears a certain resemblance to the imagined state of the Republic, but isn't at all the same. And it's much more mundane, and it's much more realistic. So I think these are the sorts of laws that Plato did think were practicable. And I strongly suspect that, I mean, the type of constitution that you get in the laws isn't a constitutional monarchy, which is what I think Plato was trying to do in Syracuse. But there are, as it were, monarchic and authoritarian elements in the constitution of the laws, which are tempered by a more democratic element as well. And I suspect, and the letter 8, I think it is, bears me out in this, that this was the kind of constitution that he was trying to persuade Dionysius to turn Syracuse into. As I said earlier, he failed.
As a last question, I know that it's a very broad question, but if you could generally tell us, what was his legacy, his impact on future later philosophers, both immediately after his death and also in general in the history of philosophy? And I guess the second part of my question I should ask, given the current political, I always like to ask the authors I talk with about the relevance of their book to the current challenges we have. political challenges, the war between, I don't know, your culture wars, you know, in humanities and science. But in general, what do you think Plato has to offer us today?
I'm going to fudge this question, Morteza, because it's something I'm not really good at. I'm not an analyst of current politics, and so any answer I gave would probably be very naive. I study Plato in his own right, and I do the same with all the people I write about. You know, like for instance, when I study ancient Stoicism, Stoicism, as you probably know, is huge right now around the world. I mean, tens of thousands of people consider themselves to be practicing Stoics. In fact, they're only practicing a third of Stoicism, but that doesn't matter. They consider themselves to be practicing Stoics. So when I translate Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, I deliberately don't read modern Stoic books. I want to understand Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius in their own light and in their own time. And my attitude towards Plato is pretty much the same. So I'm not going to address that part of your question.
That sounds fair enough, yeah.
Okay, so Plato died in 347, as I said. The Academy continued in some form or other, and a lot of the evidence is really poor, but it continued in some form or another for another roughly 1,000 years, making it a very long-lived educational establishment. It was taken over by his nephew Speusippus, then by Xenocrates, and then by one of the main ways that the Academy was enabled to continue was by this simple, clever device of appointing a head of school. So Plato was head of school during his lifetime, then Speusippus, then Xenocrates, and then we know the names of quite a few others of the heads of school going on and on. Now, as I said, it did gradually become a school for the perpetuation of Platonism. But people's understanding of Platonism changed. So in the first generations, the Academy looked, I think, pretty much as it would have looked in Plato's time. Oh, with one important difference, that in Plato's time, because he was rich himself and also because he was well-funded by incredibly wealthy people like Dio, he charged no fees. I mean, education was, in those days, was a preserve of the elite anyway. So most scholars could afford to, you know, they'd be sent money from their estates back home, and do their studies with, you know, in Athens with Plato. So for a while, I think the Academy would have looked pretty much like Plato, with the exception that they started charging fees. Again, that's just a piece of information we have. We don't know any more about it, or even whether it's exactly true. But then for quite a long time, for a couple of hundred years, the Academy changed its perception of Platonism. And they said that instead of Plato's dialogues being, as it were, dogmatic, generating ideas that one was expected to believe in or find challenging or consider, they said that Plato was a skeptic, that all his dialogues were designed to prove that you can't know anything for sure. And so for a couple of hundred years, the Academy was skeptical. Then in 87 BC, Athens had made another stupid mistake, almost as, you know, not quite as stupid as trying to take over Sicily in 415. But in about 90 BC, they joined a chap called Mithridates the seventh. Of Pontus, who decided that he wanted to kick Romans out of the Eastern Mediterranean. By this time, the Roman Empire was not yet fully developed, but it was enormous. And Mithridates wanted to chuck the Romans out of the Eastern Mediterranean altogether. For some unknown reason, Athens decided to join his rebellion. So in 87, the Roman general Sulla, who later became the dictator of Rome, besieged Athens and reduced it. And one of the things that his men did, I mean, they built siege engines to besiege Athens, and they cut down the trees of the academy park where the gymnasium was in order to do so. That's the only information we have, that they cut down the trees. But I suspect that the damage was more substantial. I suspect the gymnasium itself might have been damaged or even destroyed because, for instance, the Lyceum gymnasium, mm-hmm. also just outside the city walls, a different part of Athens, was destroyed by Sulla's troops. At any rate, for whatever reason, destruction or just because it was no longer a really nice place to hang out, the academy moved into Athens. And from this time on, for the next 500 or so years, we really know very, very little about where they met, what they did, and things like that. But we do know that it still existed at the beginning of the 6th century when Emperor Justinian closed all pagan schools and made Christianity the only instructional background throughout the Roman Empire. Places today, what I will say, not talking about politics, but I believe that as a philosopher, I believe his influence to be profound. There's a very famous and somewhat cliched, because it's so famous, saying by the English philosopher North Whitehead, who said something like, the safest way to characterize the history of Western philosophy is that it consists of footnotes to Plato.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe that to be true. I believe Plato did create Western philosophy as we know it, not just in the range of subjects that he wrote about, from ethics and metaphysics and politics and, you know, everything, but just as an approach. Philosophers have to be self-critical. Mm-hmm. They're not coming up with answers so much as trying to ask the right questions. And that's very much, you know, the flavor of what Plato does in his dialogues. And that's really why he wrote dialogues, was so as not to be too dogmatic, to let his readers or listeners, and as they would have been in the first place, think for themselves. And then, of course, we had Aristotle's body of work afterwards, which, as I say, he disagreed with Plato a great deal, but nevertheless, that confirmed the kind of direction that Western philosophy was going to take. And it did indeed carry on like that all the way up until North Whitehead and beyond. So I believe that every philosopher, every academic philosopher today, I believe, is ultimately in debt to Plato. His or her work may be completely different from anything that Plato looked into. It may be like, you know, the ethics of social services or something like that, but it's still ultimately in debt to Plato.
Mm. Robin Waterfield, thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us on New Books Network about your book, Plato of Athens, A Life in Philosophy, published by Oxford University Press in 2023. I strongly recommend this book to our listeners. It's highly accessible and a very comprehensive book about sort of an intellectual biography of Plato. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, Tessa, thank you again for the opportunity. It was great.